tunnels are underground, where none of the children will ever be found. They wandered away to join the show and lost their way in the world below. They joined the circus and left their town. Now they live here down with the clown.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast covering the adaptation of Stephen King's It, that is Welcome to Derry on HBO. This podcast is split into two sections. In the first section we call The Calm. We will only cover a single piece of It media this week, the first episode of Welcome to Derry on HBO, titled The Pilot. And we'll not spoil anything we know about Welcome to Derry, though we will talk about some of the adaptation choices that make the book different. In the second Storm section, Neil and I will break down what to expect from It, Welcome to Derry, based on the trailer for the rest of the season. We're not spoiling, we're enriching. Well, hello again, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I have read the book by Stephen King.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I still have not read this book by Stephen King because too much clown stuff. And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping, some fun stuff in the housekeeping this week. Of course, next week we'll be back to talk about Welcome to Derry episode 2. We may be in your feeds a little bit early because next week's episode is going to be in your HBO Max feeds a little bit early. It is dropping on Halloween, which is this coming Friday. Episode 2, titled The Thing in the Dark, will be dropping a few days early. So we may drop early. Either way, by the time Monday rolls around, you will have a new episode of A Storm of Spoilers. And we'll be covering Welcome to Derry for the duration of the season, which will take us through mid-December. We got some fun stuff at the end of the year. And then, of course, we'll be sticking with HBO as they turn back to Westeros in January. So, you know, keep it locked right here on this feed. You can also, if you enjoy this particular podcast, see it in video form over on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil. It is fun to see our faces, I believe. Also, speaking of seeing at least one of us live in person, in facial form, actually in full body form, Tuesday, the 4th of November, 3 p.m., I believe that's Mountain Time, There is going to be a live Fighting in the War Room podcast in the city of Denver at the Tatter Cover on Colfax, with the organizers of the Denver Film Festival, which is pretty big because that means that all of the members of the Fighting in the War Room podcast, one of the 100 greatest podcasts of all time, according to Time Magazine,
all time,
are going to be in the same place at the same time. So you can go to denverfilm.org. We're going to put a link to the show note link in the show notes of this podcast where you can get tickets to see Dave and David Ehrlich and Katie and Matt Patches.
Well, not David Ehrlich. David Ehrlich can't make it. Oh, okay. We're going to have Chris Rosen from The Ankler and the two programmers of the Denver Film Festival.
So all of the best people from Fighting in the War Room.
Sorry. Correct.
Sorry, David Ehrlich. I kid. They're all great. Go see them if you're near Denver next week. If you'd like more from Dave and I, you can join us on Patreon, patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil. More bonus content from all the things that we've done here in the Storm of Spoilers feed, and plenty of bonus content that we've done just for the patrons, including a weekly adventure pod. We just got done doing Ed Gein Month, which is why I was ready for lampshades made of skin on this week's Welcome to Derry. Because we talked about it with regard to Ed Gein and with regard to Hannibal, which is a show that we are rewatching week to week. I'm watching it for the first time. We're very much enjoying it. You get that as a podcast if you are a member at the $10 or more level of our Patreon. So join up. We've all kinds of fun stuff in there. We've done all kinds of rewatches, Twin Peaks, The Leftovers, which is also relevant for at least one of the cast members of Welcome to Derry. It's
hell yeah.
It's highly useful, that Patreon, and highly useful to me because it literally pays my rent. So that is how you get more of Dave and I. How do you interact with this show? We'd love for you to do it a little bit more because nobody did it this week. That's okay. You could send us a raven to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. That's always available to you. Send us your thoughts about Welcome to Derry. Send us your questions about the show from week to week. That's always good. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave us 5-star ratings. Say whatever you want. There are plenty on there, but none of them are new this week, Dave. So we'd love if you have some time, any of you out there, leave us a rating. Leave us a review. Leave us some thoughts. Say some things. That's it. We didn't get any emails. We didn't get any reviews. Everybody, I think, is just girding their loins, waiting for the release of the clown show, which, much to my chagrin, Dave, didn't have a lot of clown this week.
I mean, that's true. But if you don't like birth trauma, surprise, sure. Welcome to Derry is not the show for you.
But I did have to turn on HBO. So I was like, I'm sure there's going to be at least one weird birth in this show.
Very fair. That is something that HBO nowadays loves to filter in. This pilot does one of the fun things that we sort of anticipated in the storm by seeing how many episodes certain characters were credited for.
Sure.
Just in case you're interested in going into the storm. That's the sort of stuff that we break down there. But it is one of those pilots where it introduces us to a group of characters that we're like, what fun main characters, only to kill them off by the end of the first episode, which isn't new in television. It's just very selectively used in television. The first thing that came to mind, both because Hovind Adepo's here playing a main character, much like he was in a cool flashback episode of Watchmen from Damon Lindelof. Maybe think about Lost, where Michael Keaton was supposed to play the Jack character and he was supposed to die to let Kate become the main character of the series. But that was changed as the pilot was in production. There's also The Shield, sure. Which, to kind of spoil the first episode, all these I'm going to spoil the first episode of very, very good series, but I don't necessarily think that's spoilers. The good cop kind of dies at the end of The Shield, and we're like, oh, who are we left with for the rest of the season or series, which makes it interesting. X-Men the Animated Series killed off a X-Men named Morph that eventually came back, but that was supposed to be a big establishing factor that nobody was safe in the world of X-Men the Animated Series, even though all the other marketable mutants seem to stay alive. And then there are series that the death of the main character is the point of the series, thinking of things like 6 Feet Under, Dead Like Me. Mm-hmm. 6 Feet Under, I'm thinking about Nathan's dad. I'm not thinking about any of the characters that die beyond that in 6 Feet Under.
Sure.
But I guess, what would do we think it is trying to communicate to us, given these various options with at the end of this episode of the what we thought were the new losers? Only Lily and Ronnie are left alive.
Well, I think that it's an episode that is obviously trying to set a very specific tone and come out with a very big swing energy and say, you know, nobody's safe. And I think it's funny because we sort of we almost prepped for this with Alien Earth, because we spent a lot of the first season of Alien Earth watching one particular character being like, this actor is only credited as like a guest recurring star, not a main character. Why? But he's one of the main people. What's going on here? And of course, he does not make it through the season. So last week when we were like, oh, the kids who play the Teddy and what's the other kid's name? Phil, the two boys.
Phil, yeah.
They're not listed as main cast. They're listed as guest stars. So, you know, we kind of called it. But yeah, I that's one of the things I think I enjoy the most about it. I mean, the opening scene is gnarly and horrible. And the closing scene is also gnarly and horrible. It's, you know, the mutant baby, gnarly and horrible is the theme here. But I think that the show wants us to believe that no one is safe here, and mission accomplished. I think other than some of the adult characters, I don't know if I'm necessarily worried about them being in danger from the supernatural force. Mm-hmm. As much as I think that some of them might be in danger from like other adults, right?
Right.
Like Jovan Adepo's character, Major Hanlon, is, you know, probably in danger from his fellow soldiers and like America's institutional racism at the time. But I don't know if the clown is after him just yet. But yeah. These kids, man, these kids are in a tough spot. Poor Susie. She just wanted to write in cursive and find books in the library. Now she's just a hand.
She never found that basket full of muffins. As a fan of the book, there are some things that are really encouraging from this pilot, and there are some things that sort of bother me. I'll start with the bothering so we could maybe be positive as we're heading into a discussion of the rest of the episode. I am a little bothered by they had give us this great characterization between like Lily, between Phil and Lily and Teddy. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we get deeper into Teddy's life, the sort of shorthand of Jewish is they have matzo ball soup and challah bread every night.
Sure.
And the dad's a rabbi and they get to talk about the Holocaust. I like that.
They're having the most Jewish dinner.
Exactly. And I don't like that. I do like the sort of build that is, where as soon as the dad tells young Teddy about the skin lampshades, that it uses that to manifest a fear. I like the fear connection. Mm-hmm. That seems accurate to me. I'm not super, I get the Cold War setting and I love all the turtle shout outs because of the book's insistence that there is a good turtle god somewhere influencing these children.
Sure.
That being said, the idea that Derry is like the place of first attack because you'd fly over the North Pole is interesting.
That did just seem never a little silly to me. I was like, this is actually one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is like, is Derry, because they've clearly positioned Derry as like another Area 51 style Air Force base, right here, which is like, it's a little bit of a stretch to be like, this is our closest defense against Russia. I'm sorry, Alaska existed in the 1960s. So like Sarah Palin's house could still see Russia in the 1960s. So Derry is not the closest thing. But is this at all from the books? Like, was there mysterious potential alien nonsense going on at the Derry Air Force Base?
No, the alien stuff is new. I don't know why it's not in the original book, because 1958 Losers Club would be close to like this idea of this like nuclear alien sort of thing.
That stuff all made sense timeline wise.
Yeah, the stuff that happens at the airbase specifically leading to the black spot in the book all takes place in 1932. So there is a reason for there to be a buildup, because we are, you know, leading into a world war. We're in between world wars. This one, like, my understanding is if they didn't have the Cold War sort of buildup, if they didn't have this alien sort of Area 51 thing, that military base wouldn't be as big as it is. I think that's what Phil's trying to say.
Sure.
When he's telling Teddy, like, they're bringing in big cargo planes, something else is going on here. That is so not in the book. I suspect this is an invention of the series. Whatever they're doing there, whatever the secret project is, that is not in the book whatsoever.
Sure. And it appears to be, and this is something we'll undoubtedly talk about more in the storm when we get digging into the trailers for the rest of the season, but it appears to be a big part of this show's plot, which is, what is the military looking for in Derry?
It does seem to be a big part of the show's plot. And then things that I like about the series, outside of those sort of like weird not there, is I do like the chance to go back and sort of investigate what its fears would manifest as. Because as we talked about when we were talking about the movie adaptations, a lot of the Muschietti adaptations have defaulted to using Pennywise, mm-hmm. because in the book, they basically use like universal monsters, because that would have been scary to kids in 1958, but aren't going to be scary to kids now. So I do like the idea that if we are hiding the clown, like Andy Muschietti has talked about, if we're not going to get to Pennywise straight up, then we really have to lean on these fears. So something like the lampshade worked really well for me. The sort of like background details that maybe Maddie has some sort of trauma around babies or childhood that mm-hmm. is somehow mixing with nuclear fears to make a mutant baby, I think is very, very interesting. The idea of a mutant baby sort of being like a poisoned generation comes together with like Trouble and the Music Man, which I think was a really smart comp.
Sure.
So there's some things the series is doing very, very well that gives me hope. I am worried if it's going to eventually be brought down by the more stupid aspects, kind of like It Chapter 2, because although I think this episode was very effective, it does rely on a CGI monster sort of popping out several times in order to do that. However, it worked again for me in this, especially the first sequence, like after the lady in the front gave birth to the baby and the baby was like in the wheel well down at the foot and we kept like slowly pushing over to it and Maddie was like leaning to look in. I was like, I don't want to see it. And that's when I realized the show was working on me, because normally I'd be like, show me that CGI baby. But now I'm like, I'm so terrified of what this would be.
Yeah.
I don't want to see it.
And I would argue, and this is kind of true with the two It movies that we talked about in the last couple of weeks, it's a pretty good CGI baby. As far as like mutant gross CGI baby abominations go, this one actually looks pretty good. Especially in the moment, like late in that opening scene where it stops in the back seat and like everybody turns to stare at Maddie. I'm like, this as the digital effects go, this looks pretty good. And then I think in the theater at the end, it also kind of looks pretty good. So it's like,
I think the director of the DCU's The Flash will never get a bad CGI baby wrong again. I think we've
learned
correctly ripped all the skin off of his body and he's had to make it to like scab over. He's never going to have a bad looking baby again.
It's going
to
be so, it's so funny to me. And I hope that Andy Muschietti's career continues in this trajectory where he's continues to be very good at making CGI creatures so that only one of his movies stands out as being just horrifically bad looking, and it's The Flash. And people are just like constantly, like 100 years from now, just cinema studies classes are doing anthropological deep dives as to like what happened with The Flash.
What happened with that?
Because like
Flash?
Otherwise, this guy does know what he's doing with visual effects.
Yeah, I was watching, I saw on the Stephen King subreddit in the discussion about this episode, there are some people who don't like, you know, the CGI creatureness of it. And they're like, how does this guy keep getting jobs? And again, this episode directed by Andy Muschietti, like I said, with It Chapter 2, even if I'm not paying it like super into what's happening plot wise, this is extremely competently shot. Considering like we've been watching some Hannibal, which is a NBC show from over 10 years ago now. And you could notice when they have a set that maybe they didn't have time or the need to necessarily build out as much as it did, or they have a shot that is there to sort of lead to something else. It doesn't necessarily communicate what needs to be communicated. I think that's all technically very sound here in the pilot. And I guess we'll have to see. I guess the only time I felt it is in Leroy Hanlon's army barracks, which might be a good way to transition into how we're going to be talking about Welcome to Derry on this podcast.
Sure.
Which is, I think we should definitely track the losers as we add and subtract them. But I think we also, when we're tracking the adult characters, at least for this first episode, just need to track military characters. So I'm going to call this section, It's a Cold, 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 Cold War. And we're going to talk about all our military characters and what we've learned about them / what they might be doing here.
Sure. Yeah, like I feel like so, eventually we'll have to talk about like the police and the townspeople being investigated for these disappearing children. But for now, it's just the military.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how widespread in terms of plots this show is going to diversify in, and maybe we'll get more of an idea in episode 2. But losers fight it while military tries to do something to fight it is enough plots, especially when each iteration of the losers has at least 5 kids. So maybe there's not more than that, but that being said, we know from previews and stuff that the rest of the Hanlon family is going to show up. So that adds to both plot lines in some sort of way and might diversify. Definitely in the police. I did notice on the Derry sign in the opening with Maddie, They do have the Legion of White Decency seal on them. Mm-hmm. So the Klan is alive and well, in case we didn't notice in this episode. But let's
I think it's talk possible about Leroy. We may have already met some of them.
Oh, definitely possible. We already met some of those. Mr. Adepo, Leroy Hanlon.
Yeah.
How did you like this character introduction in episode one?
Well, listen, it's great to see Michael from The Leftovers continuing to cash those HBO checks, even as he grows into becoming an adult man. I'm very fascinated by the scar on his left cheek. Can't wait to find out what's going on there and what horrific injury he, I assume, got in Korea. But apparently it wasn't one of those injuries that turned him off of war or the imperial conquest. He doesn't think that he thinks that we didn't finish the job against I assume communism in Korea, right? Like he still seems pretty anti-reds here.
Pre-Vietnam I imagine this was the sentiment,
sure,
but did not by the time I was ever alive.
Sure. But well, and you know, this is an interesting, I'm curious to see if the show digs into this sentiment, right? Korea, the Korean War, and then the Vietnam War were the sort of the two wars where the, I wouldn't say sentiment, just like the vibe of American dominance in war turned very sharply, right? We had easy company in World War II. We defeated the Nazis. We took down fascism. America was the hero of the moment. And it was like, oh, we won the world war. We are the champions. And then we lost some stuff in quick succession. And we're no longer the infallible world police. So yeah. I think that it will be interesting to see sort of if that comes into play or if that's just sort of like background noise for his character. And, you know, so it is interesting to have this character who is positioned as being, you know, a black serviceman who has come to this place where there's clearly some racism and he is clearly going to be targeted, right? He's the pilot who's going to be flying the experimental B-52 bomber, which, as we know, is a pretty big deal for America. Mm-hmm. But he's still a big believer, right, in America and in that its rights can fix what its wrongs are.
Yeah, nothing wrong with America. That's what right with America can't fix,
that does feel like it's setting up an arc where he realizes that maybe that's not true.
It's great screenwriting for a TV show because I want to believe in Leroy Hanlon. That's sure. Where I am at the end of this episode.
Yeah, you kind of want to believe in the version of America he believes in, but
right. And maybe that's enough. It'll be interesting to see what the series thinks about what America is, especially if we're going to go backwards in time, not forwards in time, investigating, you know, how it has polluted dairy.
Sure.
But yeah, at the end of the episode, I want Leroy to be our protagonist more than I feel like he is our protagonist quite yet, because he has this sort of encounter with these masked men in probably my least favorite set. Mm-hmm. But that being said, some people have speculated in comment sections already, and then some people claiming to recognize the voices of actors coming out of those masks. Mm-hmm. It seems like the mask beating might have been a test as to if Leroy's going to be able to keep these secrets that this base ultimately holds.
Yeah, that was my first thought was these are not like Russians that broke into the base. These are other American dudes testing him. So whether it's like his fellow soldiers running, you know, like a counterintelligence test on him, right? Which is like, let's see if he will give up the secrets, or whether it's some like racist shit that his fellow soldiers are doing. Either way, it's definitely other American dudes, I think, because otherwise it doesn't make sense that they just kind of like let them run off into the base. Right. Mm. Like after they shoo them away, after his buddy Paulie comes in and they like get rid of him, they just like run off into the military base. Like if those are foreign spies that have broken into your very secure barracks, why are we not immediately forming parties, manhunt parties to go find them? So I think that, you know, that's TV language to tell me that those guys are just like running back to their own barracks.
On my second rewatch, I was like, General Shaw, not taking racism, gave that guy latrine duty. He's sure. Like, I'm not going to stand for this shit. On my second rewatch, I'm like, General Shaw doesn't want to think the assault. He doesn't want Hanlon to think the assault has to do with race.
Sure.
He wants Hanlon to think the assault has to do with secrets, because if Hanlon believes the assault has to do with secrets, then it's a worthwhile test. If it's just, can this dude withstand racism? Him still being alive is evidence that this dude could withstand racism.
Yeah.
So, complicated and simple at the same time. Probably the least effective sequence outside of stereotypical Jewish family dinner for me.
Well,
this
episode. I think unless there's something else going on here, it's pretty clear that what's going on here, right? Like, unless the show has written this as sort of a red herring, and these are really like secretly Russian guys. This is a pretty obvious plot device. Also, you know, I love James Remar. He's a great actor, but he's also the kind of guy you cast as the respectable general who's secretly racist.
Like, yes, absolutely.
Like, I'm sorry, but he's just one of those actors that can just do that. He's got that gear. I can see him giving a very evil monologue later in this season.
The him wanting so much to impress Leroy Hanlon and being coded so much as like, I'm a lifelong military man. I made my father proud. Like, sure. You made your father proud.
I'm the woke.
We don't
general.
Have to talk about your injury or whatever, because I know all about it from your file, because I'm a general. I do. Yes, yeah, I'm side eyeing. I'm side eyeing everybody.
There were not woke generals in the 1960s.
Another reason to distrust everybody on the military is the airman who is driving the car, who is side-eyeing everybody. He does not get a name. He does not get a name tag, unfortunately, but that is Dick Halloran. He of The Shining. And he keeps giving Leroy some side-eye whenever people say things that are, you know, like, you're going to have a good time here. Everything's going to be fine. So I can't wait for the people of color to start talking to each other honestly. That's what I hope happens in episode two.
And listen, very notable that all the other soldiers have big ass name tags that you can, so you can tell who's who, and he does not. I was like, what's going on with this no name tag guy? That's The Shining guy, isn't it?
Yeah. Also, like, with so many like Easter eggs, like when Lily gets pulled into the bathroom, there's like a little heart on the wall that says Alvin Marsh. That's Beverly Marsh's abusive father. Mm-hmm. If you're going to put Easter eggs like that, give Halloran a name tag. Like, how long are you going to keep this from us?
Right.
Like, the only people who care are people who've read the books. I don't understand why some things are being kept from us, but we see like five turtles. You know, this is, sometimes I'm a little bit smarter than this series thinks I am, and sometimes maybe I'm a little bit dumber. It's hard to tell.
Sure. But it's fine. We're having fun. It has a good pace. Has a good rhythm to it. I'm okay with it.
Yeah. I think it's a little... Actually, here's a good question. I have two questions for you. One, is there actually an experimental B-52? And if not, why would they need a pilot?
I mean, I think maybe there is, or do you think that's, are you suggesting that that's like a cover for some nonsense?
If they need a pilot,
because like the B-52 is a real plane.
Yes.
Like, and it is like, and there might be an plane.
And there might be an experimental one, and it might be about flying over the North Pole, and that would be interesting. But my thought is, he's there for the secret project. The B-52 could at this point be either excuse to bring him over and that it never exists and they need him for something else. But they also brought Polly over. So I am wondering if there is some tricky flying involved, even if there isn't necessarily a plane. I do think that him being very specifically a pilot, at least at this point, given the information I have from the first episode,
sure,
is probably important. The title's telling me it's important.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, are we ever going to see him fly a plane?
I think that's probably a safe assumption. I just don't know if it's going to be an experimental plane or if it's he's here to do some sort of flying mission that we don't know about because we don't understand it like the general does.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's some sort of experimental plane, but that's obviously not the whole thing.
Right. My second question is, if you could retitle this episode after the loser's plotline, mm-hmm. what would you have called this episode?
I would probably name it something after like the movie theater. Name it like the Capitol or just like the theater. I mean, I want to call it the Mutant Baby, but that's too on the nose.
I mean, I feel like if you just wanted to do it in a way that could be listed in press releases, you just call it Trouble. Or It Awakens.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just like the Music Man.
The Music Man. The Music Man would be funny. Which is a great way to transition to talking about the losers. The Music Man, first of all, WB property, so of course you can mess with it.
Sure.
That's, I think, a primary thing.
And also a new thing that seems to be like a Warner Brothers fetish these days, which is mm-hmm. taking one of their old movies and putting new things in it, right? Like this is, of course, the studio behind The Wizard of Oz at the Sphere, where they put like David Zaslav in the movie, among other gross things that they did. But, you know, this is far less egregious because it's just like the plot of a show. But I'm not entirely surprised. They're like, oh, fun. We'll open our series by taking one of our old movies and adding one of our several of our modern characters into the old movie because the family's there with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I first of all, the family's there with them. I only noticed the second time through.
Yeah, same.
But also, I like this idea. Like, so much in the book are the kids see movies and then it takes the form of whatever movie they see.
Yeah.
To start off with something as innocuous as Music Man, I'm like, oh man, you have so many Warner Brothers movies that you could like pull into this. I don't want it to be a Ready Player One, but it, mm-hmm. but it could do that once or twice more and I'd enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for plot reasons as well, right, like the movie theater is about to be a hot spot that I don't think that they're going to allow the kids to go back to just yet, given the, you know, the murder aspect of it.
Right.
But I wouldn't hate if we ended up back here for one more of these later in the season.
Well, Ronnie works there and her dad is the projectionist. Mm-hmm. And we learn in this episode that in between January and April, the police kept coming by trying to pin Maddie's disappearance on her father, the projectionist.
Sure.
And Ronnie mentions that she's been hearing voices in the pipes in the Capitol in the It miniseries when Seth Green meets the Wolfman, which is, you know, what a fantastic sentence. Thanks, Stephen King. It also takes place in the basement, I believe, of the Capitol, the movie theater. So this is a location we could return to. Mm-hmm. And if we do return to that, I can't wait to see what sort of characters leap out of the screen from the early Warner Brothers catalog.
And we did kind of talk about it last week about how they've maybe compressed the geography of Derry a little bit by moving, you know, where they're, what's that thing called where their clubhouse is?
The standpipe.
They've sort of moved that closer to the main street of town. And I assume Capitol Theater is also on Main Street. So it's like mm-hmm. everything seems to be right in the same spot now. So I assume we're going to find out that like Pennywise is like right underneath the main drag of town.
It seems like he's coming through there. Definitely the Capitol seems to be his new entrance point, at least until we get to Niebold Street, I would assume. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is weird. So in the making of or behind the scenes feature they released with this, it was mostly about Andy Muschietti talking about the baby. But they do talk about the Capitol Theater. And when they do, they have a graphic that is a map of Derry showing key points. Mm-hmm. And what they are labeling as the standpipe is not what I'm labeling as the standpipe. So maybe we should start calling it the clubhouse. At least that's what they're using it as.
Okay.
But it is interesting because I haven't seen a behind the scenes footage like that mark space on a dairy map, or mark a map in general. And we haven't gotten that information yet in the series.
Sure.
So seems it'll like be interesting to see.
They're thinking about more. We talked about this a little bit in our preview episodes about how it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of material. It seems like there's potentially infinite material here because they're way off book, but also potentially not a whole lot of material here, story-wise. So like this could be anywhere from like a limited one season thing. But it sounds like they have multiple seasons in mind. So it does seem like going into detail of the specific locations of Derry now seem to be very important. Whereas with the movies, it's something you just kind of like fudge.
Right. Like, I don't think we'll ever be at the Barrens as far. Actually, no, I'm sorry. We will definitely probably be at the Barrens, but we're not going to be spending a lot of time in the Barrens like we did in the movies. But like the Barrens is on the map. So we'll have to see how that evolves. I do think it's interesting that they're trying to give us sort of a spatial understanding, because I do think that could be important later on in the season, which we'll talk about in the storm, about knowing where everything else is.
Sure.
So Maddie, we kind of called this in the storm, the opening sequence, but only because they showed it at Comic-Con. But we do get a little bit more background of Maddie in a flashback through Lily. How are you feeling about our new Georgie?
I mean, poor kid. Rough. This is a rough way to go, man. Nightmare baby.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the sequence is great. From everything from him escaping the movie theater with the help of a little girl is fun, to the him getting picked up by this insanely creepy family. It's amazing to me that they keep finding little kid actors who have the same like chin and lip structure as Bill Skarsgård's Pennywise. Right, because the little kid in the car, not Maddie, but the son, the kid who's spelling.
The spelling
when
kid.
When he smiles, he's got that same weird, upside-down triangular lip structure. And I'm like, how do they keep finding these same kids?
That might be like a visual effect. I don't know. Like, it's
definitely a visual effect, like in the final scene when they do it to Maddie, but like, I don't know, man, it looks pretty natural on the other kid. but I think what surprised me about this scene is, you know, like I knew it was going to be gnarly, but I did not expect it to be quite as gross as it was. Like, especially the birth part of it. I was like, okay, HBO, like this show's very much calling its shot. And I think, you know, overall, I've talked now for several weeks about my distaste for clowns on screen. Even though this demon baby is gross and weird and very frightening, I much prefer this to the clown. Like I'm good with this.
The little kid does look like Bill Skarsgård, which makes me wonder if we're going to see later in the series how it obtained the form of that little kid. Like if we're talking about the books, it sort of like sucks a fear out of you, but it can also become physical manifestations of its victims. Think Georgie in it, chapter one and it, chapter two.
Yeah.
So it's possible that it, like that kid looks like Bill Skarsgård because that's like a tiny Bob Gray, Pennywise the Dancing Clown. And we're going to see how it obtained these forms.
Sure.
It's a possibility. I don't know if we have that much time in the series or if that's a different season thing or if the series is just not interested in it, but I was very happy with that scene because almost none of it's an adaptation from the book, but it still works. I was really creeped out by the teenage girl getting the liver blood on her fingers and just trying to touch his face.
I don't understand what that is, but it also sort of tracks for like how people are weird in the 1960s. Like they didn't have the internet, so they were weird in other ways.
Yeah. Sometimes you just, the ability to know what is a baseline normal in a relationship, in a car, is something that we really take for granted, that a bunch of these kids don't know anything. As a matter of fact, we don't know that much about Maddie. I do want to speculate a little bit here. when he's running out of the theater, the projectionist, Ronnie's father, does say, like, have you seen that kid's family? Which made me think maybe he's in, like, an abusive household. He doesn't look that good.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some sort of coping mechanism having to do with a pacifier, which seems way too young for him. So immediately I was thinking, like, trauma. But sure. Then Phil and Ted say that their mother was bribing kids with candy to come to his birthday party. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like an abusive mother. So what do you read as Maddie's familial background here?
Well, it doesn't sound like he has an abusive mother, but he also, in the scene, the flashback scene with Lily, talks about, like, oh, if my father catches me out this late,
yeah,
he'll dot, 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 you know, and I guess we can kind of fill in with our imaginations what the dot, dot, dot is. So maybe it's his father who is either abusive or something along those lines, and the mother is maybe protective and trying to, I don't know, buy him friends with candy. That's unfortunate.
So
or it's the situation that those two children are misunderstanding.
Yes.
Which seems
more, I was going to say, we talked about in It Part 2 how they changed Beverly Marsh's encounter with Miss Kirsch to be a CGI old grandma lady, but that is supposed to be the Hansel and Gretel witch. And how does the Hansel and Gretel witch get you into her house?
Candy.
Boom. But also, like, the idea that Maddie's fear is sort of like this mutant baby birth, I think, is a really interesting
sure.
perspective.
Goes with, like, the atomic age fears that are all over yes. the episode, right? The turtle saying duck and cover, and as if that would stop a nuclear bomb, which right. has always been one of my favorite things about that particular period in American history, which is, like, they're having kids hide under their desk. In nuclear bomb drills. It's like, yeah, that's not gonna do it. That's
Save
them, unfortunately.
Just gotta do something. I'm gonna save Lily and Ronnie to be our last two losers, since we're going to learn more about them. But I do want to stop and give an RIP. What do we know about our three loser deaths this episode? Phil, character I really like, very sad.
Immediately really liked Phil.
Yeah, I'm like, this kid, first of all, has the proper obsession with boobs mm-hmm. that those that age males have. I feel like, you know, Neil and I, both cis men,
sure.
Have lived through that area where it's like any sort of boobs. The idea with, like, why would they be pointy? Why would you want sure. them to look like that is definitely a thought I remember
it's
having.
It's more logistical concerns than anything else.
Yes. And then also a very early sort of Fox Mulder here and has a bunch of theories about aliens
yeah.
and how aliens are here. And that is what the government is doing. I mm-hmm. also really like Phil because he's a plane spotter, which is also a hobby that my grandfather, who was a Korean War veteran, had during World War II, which is that he used to be able to tell what planes were from, like, silhouettes. So he would whittle them and paint them black so that they could be hung inside bombers, the people targeting the guns could tell them by silhouettes.
Oh, that's cool.
So the idea of, like, young children brought up during world time taking all of these additional, not only atomic age worries, but sort of like these military might knowledge, Phil really clicked for me.
Sure. And again, they did not have anything better to do back in the day.
Correct.
They barely had television. So, and I like, you know, it's combining, the show is definitely weaving in a lot of the main sort of themes and cultural concerns of the time, which was nuclear bombs and aliens, which I personally think is great. It's fun.
I don't know how conspiracy brained this is, Neil, but we don't actually see a filled body. We see him attacked.
True.
But it's not like Susie where we see an arm, or it's not like Teddy where we see him ripped apart in the air by the mutant baby.
Phil is the one that gets slammed up against the glass, though.
Yes.
Right?
He looks pretty dead.
It looks like it gets pretty rough. But if Phil were here with us now, he yes. would want us to hold out hope, I think, that there is some conspiratorial way for him to still be alive. So, you know,
I mostly want it because I like Phil's energy. That is like the Richie Eddie energy that I want in this series. So I hope at least he's replaced with some nerd-ass shit. That's sure. what I want from my 1964 losers.
It's the tough part, though, because as much as I want to believe that any of these kids may have survived this ordeal, I've also seen enough adaptations of this particular property to know that most of these kids do not survive these ordeals. The clown usually wins. And I'm, again, for this show in particular, this particular era of Pennywise is, comings and goings. Pennywise is going to win, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he doesn't lose until much later. So I think that's bad for Phil. Not quite as bad as it is for Teddy, but bad for Phil.
Definitely bad for Phil. Speaking of Teddy, we talked about a little bit. Very interesting. His older brother, Don, that is Stanley Uris's father. So Teddy doesn't need to come back for us to have Stanley Uris. Sure. He could be dead.
Don is the well-behaved, dutiful son who is going... He grows up to be a rabbi, right?
Yes, he grows up to be a rabbi. What we know from the It novel is he meets Stanley's mother when they're in their early 20s and they get married and it is a very nice family and he is worried about his family growing up in very anti-Semitic times. So the novel It does treat Jewishness slightly better so far than the Muschietti's have treated it. In the adaptations where everybody's on the cusp of their bar mitzvah and everybody eats matzo ball soup.
Sure.
But that being said, I do think it's interesting that Teddy is the one that is our comic book reader. He reads comics, only comics of properties that will be adapted by the Muschietti's. The Flash gets thrown across the room by his father. And then later he is reading Batman and Robin versus Clayface in Detective Comics. That is the first issue that Clayface ever appeared on. By some sort of, I don't know, kismet. October 26th, I believe, was the anniversary of that issue. Because James Gunn also posted on Instagram that same comic book cover being like, congratulations on Clayface, because we know Clayface is coming as part of the DCU. I believe it's in this because the Muschietti's are directing The Brave and the Bold, the James Gunn version of Batman. And so having a cover with Batman and Robin on it with a character that is also the DCU with a issue that came out in 1964-ish all led us to this comic book cover. But sure, if you are a big It's All Connected person, maybe the Muschietti's Batman movie has Clayface as a villain. I don't know how much you want to read into it.
Sure. Or maybe Pennywise is in it. Who knows?
Exactly. But here's what I do think is interesting. Phil and Teddy, Phil being alien obsessed and conspiracy obsessed, and Teddy being comic book obsessed and somewhat fantasy minded, those were the two characters that had the best probability at this point of stumbling across what it really is. The open imagination of children is in the book what helps them defeat it with Silver, is because they think Silver is going to work, so then it works. But if you don't have a child with a mythological understanding, like someone who believes in aliens or like somebody who reads comic books, I think it's going to be harder for them to come up with a way to fight it, because all they have are these very grounded ways of fighting it, none of which I think are going to work.
Sure.
So what an interesting choice to take our two nerds out right from the top. And now I don't know where they're going to get their ideas. I guess research. Seems like maybe.
Sure. Well, I mean, we're going to need some more kids at this point.
We're going to need some more kids. One more to say goodbye to. Susie, Phil's little sister, good at cursive. I believe that actress is also the younger sister of the actor who plays Phil.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. But that also makes me think Susie definitely not coming back.
I mean, she's just a hand.
Also, her dismembered arm. That's probably a pretty good...
That's a tough way to go.
I mostly feel bad that we didn't get an idea of what Susie actually feared. She was just kind of a smart mouth little girl, which is a fantastic trope. But if I get my druthers, every character before they die expresses what they would fear and then dies in something connected to that. I think that would be good storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I like Susie's death here in what you were talking about, the no one's safe of the pilot, like kill all the children is a way to start your series. But I do wish it was a little bit more detailed. But then again, like I said, we have more time to learn about Susie.
Sure.
We could be looking for her. We could break her down. We don't know if the adults are going to realize people have been killed at the Capitol Theater. There have been times in It, the novel, where adults just don't even notice that kids are gone or that blood is everywhere. So maybe we've got more to learn about Susie coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it is, maybe this is the cost of doing a pretty good misdirect, because it is a pretty good misdirect. Like, I do think that the show does, in the course of this one episode, a pretty good job of making this like feel like it's going to be the group, right? Making this feel like it's a plucky little group, and Susie's like the tag along little sister. And it's like, all right, this is going to be interesting. We'll get to know these kids. And then it's just like, nope. Only a couple of them are going to survive. And it's not even the ones that you think that you're necessarily expecting. I mean, I guess I fully expected Lily to survive, because from the second she shows up on screen, she seems like our main character.
That's true. Let's talk about Lily. We know that she spent some time in the Juniper Hill psychiatric facility after her father was horribly killed in a bottling plant accident. Something that starts off as hilarious, and then she tells the story and you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
But the idea that her fear is sort of like pickle jars, because her dad died in a bottling accident, is like very, very interesting to me, because the storytelling part of me is like, that is right on the line of ridiculous and terrifying. How does one come up with this to be the thing? So I'm very interested to see that. I did get, through her relationship with her mother, which seems kind of cold, and through her time in the bathroom, and through hearing things in the drain, I'm getting major Bev vibes, as like, this is our female lead who has similar problems, who maybe, if we're being George Lucas and that every time's echoed, she is going to be our lead in some sort of way.
Sure.
It could be that, because, you know, she's been chosen by something, or it could be like, I've seen some people say she's the only one that's actually been blessed by the turtle. That's what the charm means. If there is a group of losers that is even capable of standing against Pennywise, they would need some sort of supernatural backing. And Lily might be the only one who has that supernatural backing.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if there is a plot armor, or if there is a magical flaming sword, to take a Terrifier reference out of absolutely nowhere, Lily would be the one to get it.
Sure. I feel like I pegged it with slightly different.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We ultimately landed on the same conclusion, but I came to it a little bit differently. I see it as a casting thing, because as I'm watching this episode, the actress's name is Clara Stack. I was like, where have I seen her face? She played young Kate Bishop in the Hawkeye series. She's when she was like baby. But I'm like, by the time I got to the end of this episode, I'm like, I see why they cast this girl. This girl can scream. Like,
yes.
She hits several just killer horror movie screams, and I'm like, this is main character level screaming. So like, this is, and I don't know if this is necessarily going to be a story in which she becomes the final girl of this scenario. The It films aren't necessarily like final girl stories, but
right,
she's got that vibe. Like, especially when she hits that one at the end, I'm just like, yep, this is the main character of the story. No, you don't cast someone who screams like that and then kill them off in like two episodes. There's just no way.
I think an important thing to remember from It Chapter 2 is, and going forward with the series, like, I also really like Lily. In theory, she needs to die by the end of this series because we don't know anything about her. But on the opposite side, we do know once you leave Derry, you forget what happened in Derry.
Mm-hmm.
So some people can get out and they will just never come back and they will never face it again. They might have some sort of influence on their lives, but they'll never notice it. They'll just think that it was like their lot in life.
Yeah.
So
she could be a totally normal person who went and lived her life with a turtle charm around her wrist forever. Never knew.
Very, very true. Then our other survivor of the massacre at the Capitol is Ronnie. It's short for Veronica. We know a little bit about her. She definitely was not keen to join the losers until she heard that they were also hearing sounds. So she's a little bit more outsidery, but now I think has been trauma bonded because only her and Lily are going to know what happened at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Where would you like to see Ronnie go in terms of her placement in the group? I think right now she's definitely in this first episode mostly used as a way to get into the Capitol Theater and to watch the movie and to do it in a way where there are no adults.
Sure.
Do we still need her for that purpose? Or is Ronnie going to transition to something else?
Well, I almost feel like the misdirect is that we have sort of like a co-leads with these two kids in the sense that we have two sort of parallel storylines, right? Like we're going to have Lily's story, which if assuming the adults are aware that something happened at the Capitol Theater, and it's not going to be one of those situations where the adults just like don't see it, then Lily is going to have to go through this thing where people don't believe her. People think she's having a sort of psychotic break. Maybe she does have to go to the Juniper Hill facility again. And then I think Ronnie is in a different position where she's going to have to like find some new allies, right? She might be on the outside while Lily is dealing with people thinking that she's crazy. Ronnie is going to have to like find some other kids that believe her and start doing some actual on the ground investigating. So I almost see her as the person who's going to have to probably more readily start recruiting some other losers here.
I like that because I was sort of wondering why very specifically Ronnie's excuse for getting involved is the weakest. She's not connected to Maddie. She doesn't have any guilt around Maddie. Mm-hmm. Her connection to Maddie for the most part is that they accuse her dad of doing it, so she should probably figure it out. But
which
that's
is a situation that might get worse if the adults are keen to what happened in the Capitol Theater. They might also try to pin this shit on her dad because not only is it happening at the theater, but you know, racism.
Well, and racism might be a good reason to shove Lily in Juniper Hill, and then your only witness is the black daughter of the suspect. So that could go bad for that family. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea, given what we've seen from Ronnie this episode, what her fear could be?
I don't know. I mean, we don't have a ton of knowledge about her character. I mean, she seems to like her dad. She seems to like movie trivia, you know.
Lives in a non-suburban part of town, kind of like Bev.
She works the movie theater. Don't quite know yet. I mean, she definitely does not seem to like being locked in the projection booth. So maybe she's a little claustrophobic. But
all right.
That's you know, maybe too easy for now. So I think we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah. I want to see if the racism is contained to the adults.
Sure.
Or if that spreads out. Because like all the kids, if there isn't something that like sort of, well, I heard in an interview that the only note Stephen King really had on these first couple of episodes were like, these kids need to say fuck less. Like 1964, kids didn't say fuck. Like it wasn't that intense. So there is some level where maybe we're just going to get some old fashioned bullying that isn't necessarily race based, and they keep the racism to the adults, so it's less awkward. I'm unsure, but it would be fun to have a fear that is a little bit more child coded, I think, and not necessarily race coded. Because you're already on thin ice with the Holocaust skin lampshades in terms of how much somebody's fear is based entirely on their external identity.
Sure.
We'll see how it goes. One more character I want to talk about, not necessarily a loser, but has high loser potential, is Marjorie, who is Lily's friend in the glasses. That actress also played the young lead on Station 11, I believe, has now grown into this part.
She looked familiar. Sure.
She is both, she wants Lily to be made fun of less. It seems like she wants to be Lily's friend, but she does want the Stacys, or one Stacy, to be the popular girl to like her.
Really? They call them the patty cakes.
The patty cakes, the patties, that's it.
Yeah.
Not the Stacys. That was me putting another name on it. But yeah, yeah.
The Stacys to me sounds like a generic name for like the mean girls, the high school. But
very fair.
So that made sense to me. But I think, yeah, they call them the patty cakes in the show.
The patty cakes. So I'm going to be interested to see how that continues. If what you were saying comes to pass where Lily has to go to Juniper Hill, that's the only character I could think of that's going to visit her.
Sure.
So maybe that's where we get more Marjorie. But it would be interesting to see. Maybe this is also the thing that brings her closer to Ronnie and maybe joins the new losers, is if Lily gets taken away and she does genuinely care about Lily. Mm-hmm. But that's an actress that I've seen do some depth, much like Lily. So if they've been cast as a young something, I'm keeping an eye on them, because that means,
I mean, her performance,
they're cast to do something in the future.
Yeah, her performance made an impression, and she didn't get killed off in the first episode. So I feel like maybe she'll be important going forward. We'll see.
Seems like it. Our IT timeline currently is mostly kept in 1964, because although I think we will be going further back in the series and adding some crazy stuff to it, our only two timeline points to the movie timeline are: in January 1964, IT takes Maddie, starting the 1964 cycle, which is confirmed in the behind the scenes. It's definitely the start of the cycle. So I don't think we'll be seeing any deaths previous to Maddie, but who knows? And then in April 1964, IT takes Phil, Susie, and Teddy at the Capitol Theater via Mutant Baby.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to put a pin into maybe we want to track its forms.
Sure.
But right now it's like, it's definitely the Mutant Baby. There isn't any question about it. I do think there will be a time in this series where we have to wonder, bad person or IT. And heads up as to where it's going to be popping up. As we lightly mentioned, it can't be the clown anymore. Or yet, I suppose. So good news, Neil. No clown.
Yeah, I'm okay with it. I mean, Demon Baby is haunting, but not as much as that clown. So, and I think, wasn't it, wasn't that one of the things we were watching for? Demonic Baby scene? It was that and Turtle Watch. Turtle Watch, huge this week. Turtle Charms.
Demonic Baby, we were also looking for based on what we had heard.
We hit the jackpot in episode one. We got Demonic Baby. Yeah. We got Turtle Charm. We got Bert the Turtle. We're turtling everywhere and demonic babying everywhere. This show is, I guess, delivering everything we wanted to see so far.
I mean, I am surprised, given some of the reviews coming out, how much I enjoyed this first episode. It does make me sort of side eye what's coming, but yeah, I thought this was good.
This is an interesting thing to, you know, the way that like the press and hype cycle works, especially if you're not watching things in advance, which I think is sometimes very useful when we're doing our podcast like this, to not be in with all the other press that are watching like the first five episodes before the season airs. Because, yeah, I think my expectations were a little bit lower reading a few clips, because it sounded like things were going to get weird. And then I watched this episode and I'm like, nope, this is kind of what I was expecting and a pretty good version of what I was expecting. So not sure what all those other people are talking about. Can't wait to find out what happens next.
It's at the same pace as in chapter two, which was, again, 2 hours and 50 minutes long. But we got about as much story in the first hour of this as we did in the entirety of it, chapter two. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that we're heading in a good direction. But we will have to see, and maybe we'll know more as we transition the storm to talk about this season on Welcome to Dairy Preview.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here.
What are you doing in the sewer?
A storm blew me away. Blew the whole circus away.
Neil.
Hmm.
I want to talk about right up top. They're apparently going to weaponize Pennywise against the communists. That was the thing I read about this series where I was like, that's what you made up? That's what you made up for this It series?
That's what the Air Force is looking for? Okay.
Mm-hmm. What did you read in terms of pre-reviews about what the Air Force is actually looking for?
I mean, that's pretty much it. That's kind of where I stopped. I was like, I don't need to know any more than this. I'll go with what's in the trailers from here on out. Because I feel like that's one of those things that context-free sounds extremely silly, but it is the sort of thing that if the show takes the right approach and the right amount of time, it could get there in a way that isn't stupid. But we'll see. You know, because I do think that like what they're setting up, right, with the military, at least, is like the military is doing some secret shit. And I think in the preview, this season on preview, we kind of get an idea of what secret shit they're doing. And they're sort of looking for the energy below Derry. And whether or not they know that's the clown is a question that remains to be answered. And this may be a situation where it's like the military has discovered that there is some sort of powerful thing resonating underneath this town. And they just don't yet know that it's a psychotic clown and alien entity just yet, right? And I think to a certain extent it makes sense, right? Like we talked about in the calm, the fact that this era of American culture was defined by both the nuclear age and the Cold War, but also the sort of remnants of the space race and the idea that maybe as Phil, our dearly departed Phil, says at one point, this idea that once humanity became a nuclear society, it made humanity a more interesting target for extraterrestrial species, right? This was something that was very much in our pop culture in the 1950s and 60s, which is like, all right, now that we got the bomb, are we going to get visited by aliens? Because we're advanced now. So I think that all of it thematically fits. It'll just be interesting to see what happens when the military finds out what actually is underneath Derry, as opposed to what they think is underneath Derry, right? Because we imagine it's going to go wrong, and it also has to go wrong in a way that the town is going to forget about in 27 years, so that in the 1980s, nobody sees it coming again.
So I think it's definitely part of that. I am unsure how much the military already knows and how much it's going to find out.
My assumption would be not very much.
There are 13 items that they are searching for in Derry. And I believe they eventually becomes the military, but I believe it starts with the indigenous people's tribe. Mm. These 13 items are part of a cage that it was in when it was thrown to our world.
Okay.
And so they think they could control it and deploy it against the Soviets if they collect all 13 of these artifacts.
Okay. Is one of these artifacts the thing that they eventually try to put it in It Chapter 2? The little vase thing?
The basket.
The basket.
I don't think so. So in the This Season On trailer, there is a shot of Ronnie, Lily, and it looks like Marjorie holding a shard that has some glowing runes on it. I think that is what we're looking for. We're looking for 13 pieces of that.
Okay.
That is going to form.
It's just going to be a MacGuffin bonanza.
It's a MacGuffin chase. 13 MacGuffins is an obscene number of MacGuffins for this sort of short of a series. Absolutely.
Eight episodes of television. Oh boy.
I hope this is a season one story. If we don't find all 13 pieces and at the end of season one, they're like, stay tuned for season two for pieces, 11 through 13. I'm going to be like, no, that's
Or if we get to the end of the season, they've only found like two.
Yeah. I'm going to be like, stop it.
So Andy and Machete into director jail immediately.
Exactly. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Back into director jail immediately.
So I think it's possible that the military is already aware that they're looking for artifacts, but I don't know why that would require a pilot. Mm-hmm. What it also looks as possible in this trailer is that the military has Dick Holler in there.
Sure.
And he is going to use his shining to basically say what you were saying, was like the military needs to figure out what's under Derry. It knows something's there, but doesn't know what. And so Dick's going to come back and be like, look, it is like an eldritch god. I don't know what you think it is.
Yeah. And we don't exactly have a turtle on our side at the moment. So like, we should not be messing with this, which is interesting. Exactly. Because it's like, my question in this episode is like, does the military know about Dick Halloran's shining? Because right now he's just driving people around.
Yeah.
So like, is this going to be one of those situations where it is revealed that like General Shaw knows what he has and has just been like waiting to use him? Or is Dick Halloran hiding it from the military and he's going to only show it to maybe, you know, our new friends?
The General Shaw actor at New York Comic Con says his character has some encounter with Pennywise. Mm-hmm. I'm unclear if that's already happened or if that will happen in the future. I'm unclear if that's the final encounter that, and then we're done with Shaw, or if Shaw has been influenced and so he knows fear. Mm-hmm. We're going to see what Shaw's afraid of and see Pennywise manifest as that, I think is very possible and a fun way to take it. But there's some other stuff in this trailer. Most of it I'm here for. The one thing that is very visual based, and I'm going to do my best to try to explain it while Neil, you get to look at the screen grab in our notes, is there's some officers talking in a police car. Mm-hmm. And we don't know who these officers are, but there is one out of focus, close to us. And I'm like, Ray Liotta's dead. Who is that actor?
I had a similar reaction. I was like, this guy looks like Ray Liotta, but it can't be Ray Liotta.
Yeah. So I'm interested in seeing that. As far as I know, we're not going to have an entire deepfake character in this.
Unless Warner Brothers is doing something that is going to completely overshadow the rest of what's going on in this show, which is deep faking Ray Liotta.
Yeah, it's a weird choice, and I'm not sure why. As far as I know, he's not a Stephen King character that would be like, oh, there's Ray Liotta from that time. but you know, maybe we'll figure something else out.
It would be a wild way to make people immediately forget about the very silly let's use Pennywise against the Russians plot line, because immediately people would be like, did you see that they defaked Ray Liotta in that fucking Pennywise show? What the hell?
Why did they do that?
It was a distraction because, you know, they wanted Pennywise to defeat the Russians.
Yep. Then we see, so the teaser starts with somebody putting on a record in what looks like Juniper Hill. It looks like some sort of mental hospital. And we had seen previously on the, I think, trailer 2, a person who had hung themselves in a mental hospital. So maybe we go there. I don't think the person who hung themselves was Lily. I went back and looked. But I do think it is possible that Lily does go back to Juniper Hill, like you were talking about. Sure. I think that's really smart. That being said, at some point she is rejoined because we do get a shot of her with the new losers, which is going to be Rich and Will Hanlon talking in the Derry High School gym. So we're going to get our new losers sort of assembled. We get Marjorie with a sort of patch over her eye, and we've seen in previous trailers sort of her wearing her glasses with her eye patch on. And it looks like she makes it at least to the missed part of the series. But she's asking, is it going to happen again? So I'm wondering if that's what gets Marjorie to join the losers, is she has a direct encounter.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it would be very Stephen King for that to be like a bully thing. Mm-hmm. Like one of the Patties does that to her eye. And just to like, that's what changes her into a loser, not recognizing that Pennywise is there, but recognizing she's never going to be popular.
Sure, sure. And then having maybe that become part of her trauma down the line and turn that into one of her Pennywise fears.
Yeah. But we will have to see where that
some
goes.
Sort of eyeball-related trauma monster.
One thing I don't really know what's about is when we're talking about, or when we see, hear some dialogue with Leroy Hanlon talking to Dick Halloran, and Halloran's talking about his shining, and he's like, it allows him to see dead people. We get a cut of some ashen hands, and it looks like Lily's hands holding Maddie's corpse's hands. I think that's what the flannel is in terms of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's so ashy, I think this might be the shot from the furthest along in the series. This seems like if they find Maddie's body, something's gone wrong with it, would mm-hmm. be my theory. But nice cover there to have two black men talking and then cut to two ashy white hands and try to get me not to notice it. I noticed. we have an actress who says in Derry, nobody ever really dies. Does this actress look familiar to you?
She does look familiar, but I couldn't quite place who that is.
I'm interested to see who says that and under what circumstances, and if this isn't it, because my understanding is Rose, the indigenous matriarch that we talked about in last week's Storm, is going to be most of our lore dump is sure. going to be contained to that.
I want to say that is the actress Madeline Stowe, but she's not listed with a character name in any of the IMDb stuff for this show.
So, interesting.
But like, I recognize her face. She's in a lot of horror stuff. So like, she's a very recognizable face, and she's definitely not the actress who's playing like Rose, who we expect to be like the indigenous woman who runs the, shop, right?
Yes.
That we've heard about in this show. So she's like a different person. So who knows? Maybe this is somebody that Lily meets in Juniper Hill. Could be.
Very possible.
But we'll see. She definitely seems to have a little bit of expository knowledge at the very least.
We get to see Joshua Adjik. Is how I'm going to try to pronounce this last name. He is an indigenous actor who is talking to the actress we know playing Rose.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to have not only some visions, but is definitely in the sewer, a red lit sewer, which reads as vision to me, but I guess we'll see how that goes. I know that being like these indigenous people have visions is kind of racist. I don't know if this series knows the indigenous people have visions is kind of racist.
Sure.
The book, it definitely does not know. It has the kids full on go into a smokehouse based on indigenous things and is like, it also worked for the white people. So I am side-eyeing this plot a little bit until I see it executed.
Right. You would think that a series being made in 2025 could pull this off with a little bit greater understanding of indigenous culture and a little bit more authenticity to the indigenous American experience, or at least a little bit more like empathy toward indigenous people.
Yeah.
Than what you would have gotten from Stephen King's writing in the 1980s.
I think there are ways to solve this. The easiest way is just give that guy The Shining. If he's going to have visions, give him the same magic that Dick Halloran has. Give him your in-universe magic so it's not the magic of his ethnic backup allows him sure. to see things. That's yeah. what I'm worried about. And then finally in this trailer, not finally, we get some shots of what's her face? She's gonna play Charlotte Hanlon, Taylor Page. floating with a gunshot in her head in the water, and it looks like Leroy has found her floating in the sewer. But then she smiles, and she's a Pennywise. So I don't think she's going to get shot in the head necessarily, mm-hmm. As much as that's a fear. A thing we haven't talked about that has also been revealed in the series-wise reviews is Leroy's injury has left him without an amygdala, so he can't feel fear.
Oh, interesting. I did. That was one of my questions that I wrote down in my notes. I'm like, what was his injury in Korea? Because they very specifically pointed out, and obviously he has the scar on his face, but you know, he very quickly is like, I don't want to talk about it. So I felt like, oh, this is definitely going to be relevant. So inability to feel fear is useful here.
That's why I like, people are like, oh, they were testing to see if he would leak the B-52. I think they were just testing to see if he'd get afraid.
Yeah.
Like the test wasn't that big of a deal. They're just like, is this guy's medical report fucking accurate? And if it is, he's the weapon. He's the person who you could send into it. And even Dick Halloran is going to get afraid, but Leroy isn't, which I think is an interesting take on it. It leaves me with a lot of questions.
Sure. It leaves me with a lot of questions for like how he ends up. Because right, like this
still
is
in Derry.
This is the dude who's then in the movie's timeline, still
the grandpa,
in Derry,
yeah.
Just killing sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be interesting to see how they square that circle at the end.
He never tells him about Pennywise. We get a different look of what I had been calling the page boy, but sort of like an old-fashioned boy getting chased by some sort of it ghoul. In this one, there is a young adult black woman that is also running with him.
Mm-hmm.
No idea what this is adding necessarily, but I still think this is towards our 1908 timeline or our 1930s time. This is a different timeline, would be my guess.
Okay.
Because none of these are characters that we've seen from the 64 time period. We have
Do you think from color grading standpoint that the fog sequences could be from a different timeline, from a different point in time?
I think, let's go right to it. I think the fog is the climax.
Oh, okay.
Of this season. We see the fog rushing into Derry. We see a lot of sequences in the fog, but specifically in this trailer, we see the kids walking and there's just a bunch of other floating kids in the fog, mm-hmm. as the kids are running through the fog. So I think this is like, it comes out. I think the wrong call last week's storm, saying maybe they've changed the black spot to a dance, because we did see in the trailer, the Patties started getting moon blinked and by the deadlights.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's a lot of kids to get deadlit. Now it looks like it's going to happen during this mist thing. And that's just so big. Like, how are we going to come back after that? That just reads finale to me. Like, if it takes over the town and it can be anywhere because it's created the mist, then that feels much more finale-ish to me than the Black Rock burning, which, the Black Spot burning, which got too losty there, which the Black Spot burning, I think, is going to be a great set piece, but I think that's as much about the evils of white supremacy as it is about it. So I'm wondering if the big supernatural showdown is the one that takes place in the mist.
Okay. And then that's the end. And that maybe the black spot fire is something we see earlier.
Yeah. Like the black spot's like your episode, your pre-finale climax. And then the mist is sort of like the final showdown. But like the mist is, if it is the mist, it is a rip in the toe dash space. So it's a increase of Stephen King's monster's power. It would make it more powerful in theory. That is a way to, I think, erase the chalkboard, you know, like everything that's learned in 1964, you literally take over Derry and wipe that all away. That would be my guess as to what's happening here with the mist, or my new guess, because we're going to have to be informed as we see. We don't know, because this is this season on trailer, how many of these events, if any of these events, take place in the next episode or not.
Right.
The last thing I think I wanted to mention is we get another peek at the black and white sequence, which we've seen some black and white Pennywise, where the only thing is the red balloon and his yellow eyes. We see a nurse sort of here in black and white, and it does look like a period nurse.
Mm-hmm.
I am not confident enough of how nurses dress as to which period.
Sure.
Do we feel like this is the 60s or do we feel like this is the 30s?
This could be the 30s. This almost looks like a stereotypical. I mean, this could be one of two things in my mind. This could either be a nurse at like an institution, sort of like the one that Lily was talking about. What's it called? Juniper Hill.
Juniper Hill.
So it could be like a flashback to something that happened at Juniper Hill. It also looks like it could be the style of nurse who would be working at like a military hospital.
I also thought Candy Striper, but she does have a very white apron, but that could just be good for black and white. But mm-hmm. I gave that thought as well.
So if we're going to get some backstory as to how the Air Force got, you know, turned on to investigating the energy under Derry, then maybe there's a flashback to be had there. So I think
could be a General Shaw flashback. He's been a doughboy his whole life.
That's true.
And then at the very end, we see the giant fire, which we're going to assume is the black spot until we're told otherwise, with the clown version. So, Neil, you're not going to be clown-free this series, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, we know the clown's coming eventually. I'm a fan of his other work.
Well, that might be a way of transitioning. Neil, what do you think the odds are we see the clown in the next episode, The Thing in the Dark?
I don't know. I am very curious to see how long they can go without the clown. Like, I think we see the
Mutant
clown.
Baby gave me hope.
I think we see the clown by mid-season. But maybe all not right, so until four? Mid-season. Yeah.
All right.
I don't think we're going to see him just yet. I am more confident in that after seeing this first episode because of how successful it was without any clown stuff. And because of how successful they were in doing some Pennywise stuff, right? Stuff that reads visually as Pennywise, the mouth specifically on like Maddie in the scene where he's in the movie, to where even audiences who are not like super familiar with the books, people who have just seen the movies, they know what that is, right? They know who's coming. So it's a very easy path to walk the audience down to just continue to give them little bits and pieces of the visual language of Pennywise without having to show them the clown. So it saves, obviously, the budget of having to use executive producer Bill Skarsgård and having to, you know, put the clown on screen, which I imagine is your most expensive thing for this show.
I don't know. I mean, this all looks pretty expensive. That's but true. Yes, we'll see what happens with the clown. But, like, that's,
you know, it's the biggest ordeal is getting Bill Skarsgård all maked up in his Pennywise get up and having him do his thing. So I imagine they're going to limit that a little bit.
Yeah, I like the presence here. Again, very book feeling to me. I'm hoping that Welcome to Derry reclaims some of the stuff we lost in the book adaptation, because Derry's a crazy place.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wait to see if they're able to make parallels beyond the metaphysical clown. We're in good directions with some of the stuff about race. We're pointing in interesting directions with some of the gender stuff. Didn't like the Jewish stuff, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. A lot of it's a little unsubtle, but
yeah,
you know, it's just starting out. So quickly.
Neil, is there anything you want to talk about before we leave you guys until Halloween?
I mean, the only other question that I am fascinated by, and I think this is something we'll probably learn here in pretty short order, which is Lily's mom mentions, reminds her to take her medication. I am curious, especially because it's the 1960s, what sort of medicating they're doing to young Lily and how that's going to manifest further and whether that's plot relevant at all. I feel like we're about to go on a really fascinating journey with this character, potentially.
That's one thing I left out of the next season on teasers. We do see the pickle scene, mm-hmm. which is something that was also shown at New York Comic Con. But basically, she hasn't gone to her dad's grave. She hasn't dealt with her dad's dad's death. She's going to be terrorized by it by finding pieces of her dad in a bunch of pickle jars.
Sure.
So that's going to happen. We'll see if that happens on or off medication.
and it really does feel like, you know, the success of this season so far is the casting of this one character. Like, they really kind of knocked it out of the park. Like, with this, with Clara Stack, she's really great. I anticipate a few more big horror screams from this girl, and it's going to be good.
If all the kids are as good as the three kids they killed, like, we're in for quite a ride.
Yep.
All right, guys, that's going to do it this week for The Storm. Join us sometime between here and next Monday, but definitely by next Monday for Welcome to Derry Episode 2, The Thing in the Dark, our Halloween episode. Until then, go out there, be excellent to each other, and don't be worried about going to see a movie in the theater. The giant mutant baby cannot hurt you. You are not in Derry.